Hello, welcome to the first episode ever of the Make Ready Podcast. First of all, I'd like to thank you for listening and giving this a chance. I'm your host, Duncan Robertson. For the premiere episode, I spoke with Armin Witt at his home office in Austin, Texas. Armin is one of the co-founders of Under Consideration, where he and his partner, Bryony Gomez Palacio, run six websites that have been part of the increasing design discourse and the broader appreciation of design practice and design practices made possible by the World Wide Web. These websites include SpeakUp, Brand New, Quipsologies, the Design Encyclopedia, WordIt, and FPO, or For Print Only. Under Consideration also publishes several self-generated projects, including the Brand New Awards and FPO Awards annual books and websites, Flaunt, a portfolio design resource for designers looking for work, and Graphic Design Reference, a visual and informational guide to the most commonly referenced terms, historical moments, landmark projects, and influential practitioners in the field of graphic design. Also, on an annual basis, Armin and Bryony host their own conference, the Brand New Conference, and the judging for both the Brand New Awards and the FPO Awards. And to top it all off, Under Consideration still maintains and operates a department of design for working with clients. Now, with all of that covered, let's get right into my conversation with Armin Witt. Here we go. Welcome to the podcast. Mm-hmm. This is Duncan Robertson. I'm here with Armin Witt mm-hmm. on a lovely Tuesday afternoon in Austin, Texas.
All right.
So, Armin, please tell me a little bit about how you became a graphic designer, how you made that decision or how you fell into it.
How I became a graphic designer is actually pretty... It's not, it's interesting, but it's not the story that most people expect, either from, not from me in particular, but from designers in general. I think people think that there's a certain romance that builds from the beginning as a kid that just grows into you, and you're like, yes, this is what I meant to, what God put me on this earth to do, right. Whether you believe on God or not. but the point is that I was a terrible student in high school. Every time they gave us grades, they had to call my mom in to talk to her about me and how I was doing. And it's not that I was dumb. I've never been dumb. I've always known that I'm somewhat smart. I was just really lazy. I hated school. This is when Sega Genesis came out. So, you know, I spent all my time playing on that thing and with friends. So I was a really bad student. I had no real ambitions of anything, of being anything. But what happened was that this was early to mid 1990s, and my dad is he's a mathematician by training. He has a PhD in physics and stuff, so he's really smart, and he's always been interested in computers. So there was always the latest computer at home. Mm-hmm. So he bought an Apple, whatever it was, the 2 or 3 at the time, and brought it home and started playing with Adobe Illustrator 88. It wasn't even version 1. It was called 88. Nice. And he started getting into it, and he was like, what does this do? Why is there a mouse? Why can I play with type? And all of a sudden, he decided that he was going to go back to school to study graphic design while keeping his job. His job has nothing to do with math. He inherited my grandfather's business, which is selling pharmaceutical products. So he was basically a businessman. Mm-hmm. He's never really enjoyed it. No one really enjoys selling pharmaceutical products. I mean, it's just, powder in a tub. So it's not really
something
exciting.
You do to pay the bills.
Right. Yeah. And, it paid the bills really well. So all of a sudden, he had the opportunity to go back to college at, age 40-something or even 50. I was in high school. And then I started seeing what he was doing. I thought, that looks interesting. At first, we're like, why is he bringing home potatoes and making seals out of carved potatoes? Like, that's dumb. But then he started bringing home logos, to do for homework. I thought, well, that's interesting.
Yeah.
So then eventually high school finished and I had to make a decision. I had to go to school for something, and I figured, well, graphic design looks like you do stuff. It doesn't seem like it requires a lot of testing, a lot of reading, or a lot of, you know, anything that resembles school. So I'll just do that.
Right.
And basically it was just the path of least resistance. I didn't want to be an accountant, a lawyer, a doctor, nothing that required heavy testing.
Yeah.
So that's how I got into graphic design. And then the first 2 years were those things, the making stamps out of potatoes and, you know, doing exercises with cutting out black paper to make abstractions of rhythm and whatnot. I thought, like, this is crap. Like, who needs this shit? And then eventually, like, by the second year, into the third year, we started making logos and business cards and letterhead. And that's when it hit me, like, oh, wow, this is really great. Like, this is fun. There's a system to it. It doesn't, again, it doesn't require a lot of, you know, like, book smarts. It's
right.
Just, like, if you have creativity and if you know how to, you know, move things around, it all works out. So that's when I started to really fall in love with it.
Cool.
Mm-hmm.
So in undergrad, and you did your undergraduate in Mexico?
In Mexico City, yeah.
Yeah.
Small, another somewhat funny story. It's in Mexico, graphic design was considered, it was called MMC, Mientras Me Caso, which is while I get married. So all it was full of girls that were just there while they got married, waiting to get married while their fiancé or boyfriend at the time, they got a business degree, and then they inherited, they went to their dad's business. So there was a lot of, you know, people didn't really care. The students that I was with, them for the full 4 years. It was 20 girls and me and another guy who was as lazy as I was in in high school. So this kind of like, after I got into it, seeing this lack of ambition from people into what we were doing really kind of like fueled me a lot to be, not me, but I became the critic of the class, where if something was crap, I would say that's crap, and I'd try to explain why. So that also started, you know, I didn't know it at the time, but my passion for being outspoken about graphic design, like seeing all these people, you know, all these girls, nothing against girls, I love girls, you know, we all do, but seeing all these girls just kind of like wasting, you know, that is money and the teacher's time, it just seemed really weird.
Yeah. That sounds a little familiar. So then that's interesting, because that sounds kind of like the model that, like, we had in America, I would say, in the, I guess it's probably the 40s and 50s is when it started to kind of die out, where there were those, like, more homemaker kind of schools where women would go to school and they'd still go to college, mm-hmm. but it was kind of designed around something for them to do until they found a husband.
Yep.
And that's how graphic design was seen in Mexico.
At least through the 90s. I think now it's changed. I think there's more understanding of what graphic design is. There's a specific design school just about design. So, yeah, I think awareness has increased. So that's, you know, it's changed definitely.
That's fascinating. So then you went from there, you moved to Atlanta?
Yeah.
And did you move to Atlanta for graduate school?
No, I moved there for a girl,
okay.
Who is now my wife. So I had never had an official girlfriend up until then. You know, I was, 19, and then I met Bryony, and, you know, we became boyfriend and girlfriend, and then she was going to graphic design. She was also studying graphic design, but at another university.
Okay.
And at some point, 2 years in, I think, she said, I hate it, mm-hmm. and I want to go study abroad. And I still had a year left, or 6 months, no, a year left, and so she looked around for a few schools in the U.S., you know, between SVA, School of Visual Arts in New York, and then Portfolio Center in Atlanta, and that's where she decided to go. And I remember telling my dad, I said, like, oh, you know, I'm thinking about doing a grad course with Brian and go with her. And he was like, no, I'm not paying for another degree. You don't want to go. You don't want to go to school anymore. You just want to be with her. Like, if you want to be with her, I'll pay you, you know, 3 trips a year to go see her, because it's going to be way cheaper than me putting you through school again. Yeah, like, if you want to be there, just find a job and do it. And if you like it and then you think that you need more education, then you do it on your own. I was like, okay, Dad, but you know, I still went after the girl.
Yeah.
So she went to Atlanta to go to school. I got a job there, and then yeah, that's how I ended up there.
Cool. So you worked while she was in school in Atlanta.
Yeah. So this was 1999, where the .com era started. Mm-hmm. So there was a lot of opportunities. There was a lot of design jobs all around. So I was just lucky that I found. The way it happened was that Brian had moved to Atlanta. I was still trying to finish my undergrad thesis and get it all done. And I went. I saw that the AIGA had a portfolio review day.
Yeah.
So I called from Mexico saying, "Hey, I'm from Mexico, but I'm a student. Can I come?" I'm like, "Yeah, as long as you pay, you know, you can come."
Sure.
So I went there. They had the usual setup with a bunch of tables, a bunch of professionals, and we all went around. Eventually, I met a woman who said, "I'm not hiring, but you should meet my husband, who's hiring." And her husband happened to be the creative director of a really large internet consultancy place that had, it was called US Web CKS at the time. They had, when I first went there, they had 200 people. And on the spot, he literally gave me a job. He was like, "Wow. Your portfolio is pretty good," even though my portfolio was pretty undecent. I mean, it was fine, but nothing that would get me a job today.
Student work, you think? Or do you think it was below what you would consider student work now?
No, I guess it was student work. I guess just looking at it, it's so different from what I do now. Or the
more hypercritical of my work.
Yeah. But even the way the portfolio was presented was just really bizarre.
Yeah.
So anyway, he gave me a job, and it was really just, it was, because also being from Mexico, I had to get a work visa,
yeah,
which is really, it's expensive for the employer, and it's time consuming because you have to wait 3 months. But he was like, "Yeah, we'll make it happen. We'll wait for you. We'll pay for it." And it was really being in the right place at the right time. That same thing could not happen today. Like today, you see job listings and they say you either must be a U.S. citizen or, you know, have a way to get a visa on your own. So it really helped that it was, you know, good economic times.
Yeah, cool. So from there, I guess we could fast forward a little bit. You moved on. I know you've told me before that you and Brownie ended up in Chicago for a little while, and then you ended up in New York working at Pentagram.
Mm-hmm.
How long were you at Pentagram?
2.5 years.
2.5 years.
Yeah.
Okay. And I'm assuming that was kind of a formative experience?
Yeah, it was really the best experience anyone can have, mostly because you're operating at the highest level in terms of the kind of clients that you get, the kind of projects, the kind of, you know, the bosses that you have, are they're considered to be the best designers in the world. If not the best, some of the best. So it was really nice to see how, to see that graphic designers by themselves can push really complicated, not complicated work, complex work for big clients where, you know, I always had the idea that you needed to be a landlord or a future brand that had, you know, five account executives and project managers and creative directors and, you know, 40 junior designers working on something, whereas Pentagram was just every project had the partner and one designer, and that's all it took. So it was really nice to see that. And the partners, they're all graphic designers. They're not MBAs. They're not, you know, they just really like design and they understand clients. So it was really nice to just see how that works and that it can work, that you don't need, a team full of people.
How do you feel like you got from having a subpar portfolio to working at Pentagram? Like what happened?
It's funny because I'm preparing a presentation about this, and a lot of it has to do with just looking at a lot of work and doing a lot of work. The two things that really helped me was that in Chicago, I wanted to work with a really small design firm. And we did a lot of really fast work, simple things like business cards or covers for a magazine, things like that, that just moved really fast because we didn't have big clients, so the requirements weren't that big. So I ended up doing a lot of things. With Pentagram, you know, it was the opposite. It was a lot of big things, but there was a lot of them. I mean, at any time, I would have 10 projects going on in parallel.
Wow.
So a lot of it is just that of looking at graphic design, seeing how the best people do it, and then kind of practicing. I mean, it's just like any professional athlete. You know, most people, some people are born gifted, but, you know, the rest of them have to shoot, you know, 100 free throws a day to eventually make them. So this is the same with graphic design. I just practiced a lot on my own and at work.
Do you feel like you learned, you were saying that at Pentagram it was really interesting to see that you could have designers running the business and getting the clients and all that. Did you learn, did you get the opportunity to learn a lot about that there? Did you get to see the kind of the works?
Yeah, that's another amazing thing. I mean, I think Michael was a great, I work for partner, for the partner, Michael Berut. I think he's a great designer, great ideas. But what amazed me the most was his openness about the business side. Okay. And he would share with me the proposals that he would send to clients with how he would, how they would approach the project, how much it would cost, how many hours. Every month or so, we would have the whole team would have a meeting, and we would go over how much money we had billed the client up to that point, how much we were left to bill, and we would work on decisions like, we still have to bill them for $20,000. How are we going to spend it, or do we give it back to them? So there was a lot of, he was very open about just the numbers.
Okay.
And kind of like making those decisions that you think they're so critical, mm-hmm. but you just make them like, these people owe us $20,000 and we're done. Should we, give it back to them and say, look, we have nothing else to do and you should keep your money for your business? Or yeah. should we find a way to, squeeze it out of them? So a lot of it is just like, meeting with a client for the first time, he would be like, how much do you think this job is worth? And I would say $35,000. He would be like, no, we can get $100,000. Like, wow, all right. So it was a lot of that was really, designers are so secretive about money that it was refreshing to just see someone so open about it.
Yeah, honestly, that's a big part of the reason why I started this show, I guess I'd call it, is that it's in talking to designers and trying to find out that information as a student and as somebody who didn't study it in undergraduate, trying to figure all of that out. It seemed like pulling teeth to try to get anybody to talk about it. And so it's been great to see the people that I've been able to talk to when we sit down, they are willing to talk about it. So that sounds like a really good place to work. What took you from there to starting your own studio?
I mean, we had started the blogs on the side since 2002, and I started working at Pentagram in 2005. So we had this side project always with blogs, starting with Speak Up. Then eventually, when I was at Pentagram, I started Brand New, which is now our biggest blog and the main driver of our income. Mm-hmm. So we always had that, but we never pushed it too far because we always had the main job. Both Bryony also had her own job, and they were very time consuming. Mm-hmm. So really, the trigger was when my first daughter was born. I don't think Pentagram knew it at the time, but another friend of mine that worked there, they also had a baby at the same time as we did, and he found out that dad's got 3 months off at half pay. Mm. So I took that. I took 3 months at half pay, and I loved being, all day long with my newborn kid, even though I didn't do anything but shit and cry and, just be a blob.
That's what they're supposed to do.
Yeah, there's not many requirements at that age.
Yeah.
So when I came back, I thought, I'll just go back and I'll be, great as before. Mm-hmm. And what happened was it was completely natural. It was organic. It wasn't that I was being, too sensitive or anything. But what happened was that I hated being there all day long instead of seeing my kid. And I hated the fact that I was looking at my watch all afternoon, like, is it 5? Is it 6? Can I leave yet? Mm-hmm. So it wasn't fair for me. It wasn't fair for Pentagram that I wasn't, because at Pentagram, you have to go full on. I mean, it's sure. a, 10-hour a day job at least. And not because it's a sweatshop. It's just that's the amount of time it demands for the work to rise to their level. After... I think I was back for 3 months, and I said, look, Michael, I wish I could keep doing this, but I just can't. It's not what I want to do. I can't be here all day long, and, Brian and I have decided to go on our own. And we decided to do it out of our house so that we could be with the kids more, which sounds almost like torture to some, but that's what we wanted to do. And seeing that we were growing revenue from our blogs, and we figured we would get some freelance projects from both my clients and Ryan's clients. And we literally sat down at a coffee shop. We grabbed the paper bag that they gave us a muffin in, and we wrote down like how much money we're going to make in the 6 months. How much money do we think we're going to make? And, you know, it averaged to something like $7,000 a month. And, you know, we figured we could survive on that. And that's how we started.
Cool. So most of the clients that you had when you were first starting out, you feel like Pentagram would kind of pass you work? Is that what you mean?
Yeah, no, it was also a good time. It was a good economic time. So Michael had a lot of work. All of Pentagram had a lot of work at the time. And part of what happened was I had been working with a really large client, but we're almost closing down on it. And Michael just didn't want to pass it on to another designer that would have to like pick up where he left off. Mm-hmm. So he said, just take this. And, you know, it was a $20,000 thing that, you know, for Pentagram, it's fine. You know, it's a good chunk of change, but it doesn't make or break the bank. Whereas for us, it was like, wow, this is 6 months of, you know, paying mortgage or
nice
whatever.
Gift.
And then it just happened organically where Michael would be like, all right, you know, this, you know, I have this one, but I can't take it on, and you take it on. And then other clients just went with us, because they assumed that they would get a little bit of that Pentagram flavor without the Pentagram price.
Sure.
And Michael was cool with that from the beginning. I said, what do I do if someone approaches me and gives me work that was your client? Mm-hmm. They're like, take it, you know, you're not going to steal our big projects. You're not going to take our livelihood. Yeah. You know, whatever we can do to help you, it's great.
It sounds like that openness that he brought in about the business side of things made you feel like you could just be
yes.
open with him.
Mm-hmm.
So when you had those questions, you could just ask. That's
yep.
really great.
Mm-hmm.
I could see a lot of situations where a designer wouldn't feel like they could ask that question.
Right. Or they, you know, from the beginning, they signed a non-compete. And,
yeah.
you know, for 2 years, they can't take on any work from either a specific client or client in that industry.
Yeah. And that always seems to be, I know a lot of people sign those. They
yeah.
don't always seem to work black and white.
Yeah.
But yeah, cool. So it sounds then like the blog was kind of all you had to do to promote yourself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the blog helped in getting my name out there as, you know, this weird guy that wrote about graphic design day in and day out that had strong opinions. They were not the right opinions or the wrong opinions or the best opinions, but I was putting them out there consistently. I built, you know, a writing style that people find entertaining. So that gave me some notoriety, and then working at Pentagram gave me credibility. Like, you know, I'm not just, you know, some blogger, but I'm actually a blogger that understands graphic design and does it you know, at some sort of higher level than other people. So that really worked in giving me a lot of, in people saying, well, you know, this guy must know what he's talking about.
Yeah.
So then after leaving Pentagram, we put more energy into the client, into our blogs. And we just kind of like rode that way, that combination of being known as graphic designers, but being known for providing this kind of like service, entertainment service of, staying in touch with the graphic design industry.
Mm-hmm.
And that's sort of what we're known for,
yeah.
that combination. Like, we're not just publishers, we're not just graphic designers, we're both.
Yeah. That kind of takes me back a few steps, I think, but it brings up an interesting question. Do you feel like having the blogs helped you get the job at Pentagram?
Oh, yeah, it was totally, I met Michael through Speak Up, which was our first blog.
Okay.
And I remember we had gone to, Brian and I had gone to a wedding in the Dominican Republic, and I was, you know, I was obsessed with finding an internet cafe so I could always be checking the comments on uh-huh. Speak Up. And one day I saw that Michael had left a comment, and I just completely freaked out, like, oh my God, Michael Brood left a comment on my blog. And, you know, we just started an email relationship like that. And basically Michael said, when he finally offered me a job, he at some point I asked for a job and said, no, you're not going to get one because of various reasons. But then he eventually offered me a job and he said, like, I know that you understand graphic design because I've seen you write about it. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I mean, I've never seen your portfolio, but I see how you write about graphic design. I see that you understand it. And I see your blogs, they're well designed. So, you know, if you want the job, here's the job. So, yeah, it was literally a direct line from blogs to Pentagram.
So, yeah, you kind of went blogs to Pentagram plus blogs.
Yep. it was a good equation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Nice. Very nice. So, so then it sounds like maybe part of the decision to keep the studio just you and Bryony was financial. Was there any other consideration? Did you think about the idea of having a larger studio or growing, or was the idea always to just have it the two of you?
Yeah, for I mean, it was at the time and it is still now to just be the two of us, plus interns. One, because it keeps things very, very simple. Mm-hmm. You know, we just have to worry about making enough money for us to survive. Mm-hmm. And also for, you know, a few, whatever, luxuries, whether it's HBO Plus or whatever. You know, it's not that we're living grand here. So that's one thing, just to keep it simple so that there's not enough pressure, so that we can work from home, so that we don't have to have an office and pay extra rent, whatever it is. So it's been a very conscious decision to just keep it as simple as possible. And I also think I'm not the best boss. I mean, I think I'm okay directing people, but I don't think I'm the right boss for a lot of people. So that's another thing that I'm not. I like doing things. I like to sit down and code a website. I like to make the small decisions. Part of it is because I'm a control freak. and I'm not good at explaining to others what I want to happen. Mm-hmm. So that's another reason.
So it's not for lack of ambition, but just for that's how you like it.
Right, exactly. Yeah, because every now and then I think, like, man, if we hired a programmer, I could have all these crazy ideas that I would have about, you know, to make the blog better, or to make other, like, mini-sites, or if we hired a writer to just bang out a lot of things. Mm-hmm. It would be so much. We could have more content and have more people reading it. But then I think, oh, well, then we need an office. Then I need to explain what needs to happen. Then I have to let someone else do something that I know I can do. Mm-hmm. Not that I can do it better, but I know I can do it and I enjoy doing it and I like taking credit for doing it. Mm-hmm.
You see that as a challenge?
Yeah, yeah. And
if you didn't know how to do it before, you can figure it out.
Yeah. Yeah, so a lot of what I do, I enjoy the fact that I wasn't supposed to be doing it. You know, I was the lazy kid in high school that all he did was play video games and watch TV. You know, I wasn't supposed to be, you know, speaking at conferences or writing books or whatever. So I really enjoy that feeling of, like, you know, screw you all. You know, I did something because I found something that I care about, not because someone said you need to learn math or you need to learn about the history of the Jews because I went to a private Jewish school. You know, like, I couldn't care less about the history of the Jewish people. I mean, sure, it's part of my theory, but as a thing that I need to learn, like, I couldn't give a rat's ass, whereas graphic design is something that it's not that I'm passionate about. I mean, I like it and love it in a way. I just, I get it. So I found something that I'm good at.
Yeah, you could easily be confused for being passionate about it.
Right, yes. I don't want people to get the wrong impression about me.
It is something you spend a lot of time on. So you mentioned that you feel like you're kind of a control freak, and then we've talked about that the studio is you and Bryony plus interns. How do you, I guess I'm mostly curious, between you and Bryony, how do you divide up work? How do you decide who's going to do what or how it all shakes out?
It's been really organic from the beginning. We never said, you're going to do this, I'm going to do that. The web stuff, she has no idea how to code and no interest in it at all. So anything that goes online, I'm responsible for it. So for the most part, that's, you know, all the blogs, all the conference websites, the awards websites, the systems of how that works behind the scenes, I'm in charge of all of that. Writing for Brand New. At some point, she tried writing for Brand New. She just struggled a lot, so she decided, I don't want to do that. She took over FPO. when we were doing more client work, she's always been really good at doing brochures and layouts and stuff like that. So she took care of that. A few of the books that we've done, she's designed those. And a lot of it has to do with time. She only works part-time from 8 a.m. in the morning, and then she takes care of the kids in the afternoon. Mm-hmm. So that leaves me in charge of more things.
Okay.
So it's really been, we've never thought about, oh, no, I want to do this. Or sometimes I have to say, like, look, I want you to do the FPO Awards logo just because you never get to do it, you know, and mm-hmm. it sucks that I get to do all the fun, you know, quote unquote fun stuff.
Right.
And she'll start it, but then she runs out of time.
Okay.
And I have to be like, all right, I'll take that idea and just do it myself. Not because I'm a control freak. With her, I can't be a control freak.
Yeah.
Which it has to get done.
Sure.
So a lot of it just, it's a matter of the circumstances that we've chosen to put ourselves into.
Yeah.
That just have kind of like specified who does what. And I end up doing more of the stuff.
Yeah, it sounds, like you said, it sounds like a pretty natural division. And it's fallen to who feels like doing what. It's nice that you can do things that way and things still get done.
Mm-hmm.
I guess in the long-term vision for Under Consideration, it is to just kind of keep doing what you're doing.
Yeah, one thing that, so far, until now, we've tried different things. Like, we've introduced new blogs, we've introduced the conference or the awards, things like that. And now it's been 4 years, this is going to be our fourth year doing the conference, it's our third year doing the awards, and those first 3 years for each, it was kind of like testing to see if we could do it.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that we lost money, it's like we spent more money on doing some of the things than we, not that we should have, than we should have, but we just not knowing what we're getting ourselves into. We spent a little bit more money on things. So what we're trying to do now is get better at doing these three things. Well, the conference, the awards, and the blogging, how to do it better, how to do it more efficiently, and just grow those things a little bit, you know, more incrementally, as opposed to saying, you know, by 2020 we have to have 10 blogs.
Mm-hmm.
Because we've never said the blog, all the new blogs have come pretty naturally. So we do a new one if it comes up. So we don't know if, 5 years from now we'll have just one, we'll have 10. So the main long-term view is just to keep doing what we're doing, which is basically doing things on our own terms for graphic designers in a way that is interesting and engaging, and that it improves on things that exist. You know, we want to improve the awards. We want to, the awards experience, the conference experience. We don't want to reinvent the wheel. We just want to make it a little bit better or more interesting or with a different twist.
So it sounds like you had an exploratory phase that was very healthy that kind of let you naturally decide, oh, this is what we were good at, or this is what we want to do, let's try that, and now you're going to have kind of a refinement period.
And the fun thing about that is that we still have crazy ideas every now and then, and, you know, we've talked about some kind of national flaunt. Flaunt is our book about how to make a portfolio.
Mm-hmm.
So we thought about some kind of, like, national tour of workshops around Flaunt, because it does really well financially, because a lot of students get it. So we thought about that, but we just haven't been able to pull the trigger. Like, if we did one every month around the U.S., you know, one of us has to travel every month. We have to find a venue. We have to find all these kinds of things. So we have ideas that we haven't really put into motion. So you never know when we're going to do it. And that's part of the fun of this, that there's always different directions that you can go with what we have,
mm-hmm.
and still find new ways of kind of like exploring revenue possibilities for what we're doing.
Yeah, that's very cool. And so you've landed in Austin. It seems like the nature of the work that you're doing kind of makes it so you can live anywhere. What brought you to Austin as opposed to staying in New York or going back to Chicago or, I don't know, there's so many big creative cities.
The main, When we moved out of New York, the main reason was we wanted to get out of New York. Not because we hated it, we loved it, but it's expensive. It's hard to raise a kid in that city. It's hard to have a kid in that city. I mean, just going anywhere, you have to get a stroller down the stairs to the subway, and then get in a crowded subway, then get out of there. By the time you get where you're going, you're all tired. So a lot of it was getting out of New York to find a more livable place, something healthier, something not healthier, just healthier in general, where you can breathe and there's not so much noise. So a lot of it was just a lifestyle decision that we wanted to be in a place that was more normal, for lack of a better word. So a lot of that means no big cities, because big cities require that same energy and that same stress that New York has. Sure. So basically, and Bryony doesn't do well in cold weather. Mm-hmm. So that took out anything on the East Coast, anything on the Midwest. Everything's too cold. We don't like the West. No offense to anyone in the West Coast. We just don't like it. So that leaves you with like stuff in the middle, and there's not much stuff in the middle. And at some point, I told Bryony, like, so what about Austin? Like, I thought, I've read a lot about Austin, and she said, Austin, Texas?
Had you been here before?
No, never. Okay. I had just heard about it, you know, had heard about South by Southwest before it was what it is now.
Yeah.
You know, you just kept hearing about this city that's kind of like quirky and interesting. Mm-hmm. Basically, the most I knew about it was the slogan of Keep Austin Weird. Yeah. I thought, well, you know, if a city in Austin can have that slogan and, you know, thrive, there must be something right going on. And what sealed the deal was we visited on, it was like January 3rd, right after New Year's. And, you know, New York was 30 degrees and gloomy and whatever. And we came here and it was 80 degrees and sunny. And, you know, our daughter was in shorts. She was running around a playground. And we're like, this is it. Like, yeah. Why would we want to go back to New York or anywhere like it? And, you know, as small as it is, and even though it's not considered a big creative city like San Francisco, LA, New York, Philadelphia, Boston, whatever, it still has, you know, a big creative energy. Mm-hmm. Not so much in the graphic design area, but just in general. Like, even the tech people are more creative here than in other parts of the U.S. So that's what attracted us to Austin.
Yeah, it's definitely hard to argue with Austin winter and spring.
Yes.
Yeah. And when we get into summer, it's a little more miserable, yeah. But if you don't like the cold, that may be good.
Yes.
So I think you mentioned before that in Under Consideration, with all of the self-generated work and the blogs and things, that you're still open to taking on clients. So one of the things that I'm interested in is how designers choose those clients, or you know, if there's a way that you've built the business so that you attract certain clients. In this case, it seems like you've got it set up so you don't always have to take on a client. So is there a kind of a luxury to that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's definitely a luxury to not having to take on work because you need it, because you need to pay to pay salaries, which we don't have to, but even if to maintain our lifestyle, we would need to take on certain kinds of clients or projects that, you know, you take them on because you think, oh, it's good money, might be interesting, but you know from the start that it's just not going to be interesting. Mm-hmm. So now, we don't get approached for a lot of design work. So it's not like we're snobs and we're rejecting clients saying like, no, we're too good for you, or we're not interested. Mm-hmm. So we don't get approached that much. When we do, you know, it literally might happen 3 to 5 times a year, mm-hmm. Which, you know, if you were a design firm, you would be doomed. I mean, if you get approached for work 3 to 5 times a year, you're running a bad business.
Sure.
I mean, it's funny, we did a client project at the end of last year in December, and the last time I had opened my... I have kind of like a template for filling out a proposal, mm-hmm. With prices and time estimates and what we do. The last time I had opened it was 1 year before.
Oh, wow.
So in a full year, we hadn't made a proposal to a client. So when a client comes in, you know, I'm interested in corporate identity. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if someone says, oh, we want you to do packaging, you know, I'd be interested to do packaging if all we were doing was graphic design. But as a standalone project that we take on every now and then, it'd be like, you know, I don't want to get into the whole consumer thing. And so a lot of it has to do, if it's a corporate identity project, I will most likely take it, mm-hmm. Just because I really enjoy the whole process of coming up with a logo and a system. And you just got to make sure that you're, you know, that we're well paid, because corporations benefit a lot from their identity. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if someone says, I have $3,000 and I want you to do an identity system, like, you know, no, I mean, because the effort that I want to put into it is more than that money.
Right.
So it has to be someone that wants to really take it on as a full project and sees the value of it, sees value in it as a part of their business. So what that means is that it has to be, you know, the corporate identity or editorial or stuff like that, and it has to pay well, because there's a lot of grievance that comes with clients. There's a lot of friction that is usually what results in great work. But all the requests, all the meetings, all the phone calls, they're really just a real drag that now, not experiencing it full time, is really horrible when we actually take it on.
So I was going to ask you if you ever miss it. It doesn't sound like
no,
you
I don't miss the meetings. I don't miss the phone calls, the conference calls. It's just really, it detracts from the work. Which what happens here is, like, it's not that we're doing the best graphic design for our own projects, but, you know, they're going through quickly. We just do what we want. And it's not that our solutions are the best ever, but it's just our vision. Again, it's not that our vision is the most amazing vision of any designer, but when you remove that interruption from a client, it really makes a project flow, and we really enjoy that. So, you know, if a client comes in and it looks interesting, and I think that I'll enjoy that friction.
Mm-hmm.
And usually at the beginning of the project, I'm like, oh, yeah, I remember why I enjoyed this. But, you know, a month later, I'm like, you know, can this jerk just pick a logo?
Yeah.
It's not that hard. Just pick one and go with it.
Yeah.
So.
So you don't have to deal with clients very often. So I guess you don't have to have a lot of systems in place for what to do with when they do get difficult or anything like that.
No, I mean, and a lot of it just, it's easier to solve nowadays. Part of it, and again, it's not to sound like a snob or that we're all powerful, but now if a client starts getting weird or being too difficult, mm-hmm. I'll just say, like, look, just take what we've done so far and go find someone else to do it. Like, we don't need the money.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it's not because we're rich or anything. It's just that the client work for us is a bonus. So when there's a really nice sense of freedom that you can say, like, look, if you don't like what we're doing, I'm not enjoying this, you're not enjoying this, here, find someone else to do it. And, you know, we've done it in the past where,
yeah.
And we walked away from a $30,000 payoff at some point because the client was just being a real, I don't want to say jerk, but they were just being really difficult and not explaining what they wanted. And we just kept doing work that we thought was really good. And they just kept saying, like, no, no, no. And I was like, right, you know, this is it. You know, we're not going to give you a lot of warnings. We're just going to stop doing it. You know, it's not. Part of it is that we realize we're not going to get you where you want to go.
Yeah.
So let's just, you know, it's cut our losses. And
yeah, it's probably the way more design projects should go. But
yeah.
You have so many cases where the designer or the design studio or firm or whatever the case is, they're so dependent on getting that check
yeah.
that they have to smile and just
yep.
grin and bear it.
And it, which is, you know, I'm not knocking that. It's a perfectly acceptable way of making money.
Sure.
And God bless the people that, you know, can do it and do it well. And I've done it. But I don't miss it. And it's really nice to be able to say, like, look, you know, it's not going to work out. So let's just get on with our lives and find better people to do this with.
Yeah, I mean, the model that you're working in may not be for everyone, but it's a nice model for younger designers or students to realize is a possibility.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like you're saying, if you, you know, maybe you don't feel like the work that you're doing is at the highest level, but that's not the point.
Right.
You know, the point is to get it out there
mm-hmm.
and to not worry about if you're, to develop your own voice, you know, and not worry about if that voice is what someone else expects. Then you found that obviously people really enjoy it and they like it, you know?
Yes.
And so there's, I think a lot of designers have that capability, and they, you know, we tend to beat ourselves up a lot.
Yeah, a lot of it has to do with the fact that there's this kind of like predetermined career path that you need to, that you should take if you want to be successful in this field, which is you get a job, you learn, then eventually you set up your own studio, and you repeat. And then you get new young designers that will learn from you, and they will set up their own studio. Mm-hmm. So it seems like, you know, there's one or two ways of doing it, and that's it. Right. So here we, you know, it's not, and I don't think this is for everyone, because, you know, what we have is that we have a large audience that we can turn to for our projects, and that's taken, you know, a good 10 years to build. So it's not something that you can just walk into or say, you know, I want to be a blogger, or, you know, I want to be a design publisher, not worry about clients. It's really, you know, it takes a long time to do it.
Yeah, because it's important for people to hear that equation we talked about earlier, that you had the blog while you were working somewhere else. That helped you get a job. That helped you earn more credibility and respect as a blogger. And then taking that, the combination of those two things together made it so that you could make a living off of that.
Yes.
You kind of had to, start on the side.
Yeah. And that's how most people that have a job and then they start their own design firm is the same. They'll have their day job and then they'll start taking on freelance clients. And then all of a sudden, they're doing more work on the side that they enjoy more. And then they say, well, screw this. I'm going to go here. Mm-hmm. Because this is what I really enjoy doing. I'm doing it on my own. So that's the path a lot of the times that they find. Or even someone that says, oh, you know what? You know, I'm going to start silk screening T-shirts at night. And then they have Threadless, you know.
Sure.
I mean, that's not what happened with Threadless, but it's an example that you never know when your side project is going to become your livelihood 5 years down the road. And a lot of it has to do with, one, being interested in that secondary thing and then not being afraid of just pushing it out to people. Like, if it just stays in your basement, you know, like, who cares? So that's what I always tell people, like, no matter how dumb you think it might be, you never know when it's going to strike a chord with someone, and that might lead to something else.
Yeah, it seems like so many of the best ideas are those ideas that if 100 other people had that idea,
right,
it was just written down, if it was ever even written down, you know, maybe written down on a scratch piece of paper and thrown in a drawer somewhere, and they just thought, oh, that's dumb, I'm not going to try that. And then the next thing you know, that's somebody's next big idea.
Yeah, I mean, the best ideas are not the most clever or the most funny or the most, you know, innovative. The best ideas are the ones that get made.
Sure.
You know, if you put it to use and other people see it, then it's up to other people to decide whether it's good or bad. But if you never put it out there, then, you know,
right,
who cares?
Right. Yeah. So that's kind of a nice segue into the kind of the last section of stuff I wanted to talk about. An important part of what I want to cover with this show is kind of advice for people who are starting out. So, for one, what would you say is the most important thing that you learned, I guess, as a designer?
I think it is that good design takes time. You can't just sit down and think that in an hour you're going to come up with either a great layout or a great logo. It really is about, it's not about some magic formula of inspiration and juju or whatever. You know, no one has that. Most designers, the good ideas come from sitting down, thinking, and doing it. And anything good takes time. So a lot of it is refining, looking at it, you know, being critical of it, and then keep doing it until that you think it's up to a certain level. So I think that's the one thing that I really think other designers miss, that it's not that you're just creative by, you know, by divine influence. You are creative by working at it.
Sure. Mm-hmm. What do you think the hardest part of being a designer is?
I think the fact that a lot of people think that graphic design is some kind of mode of self-expression, or that graphic design is personal. Graphic design is fonts, colors, pictures, you know, layout. That's it. You know, you're doing it, but the thing is, so the point of that is that people get really upset where a client says, no, I don't like that, or when some other designer or critic says, that's not good enough. You know, it's just shapes. It doesn't reflect you as a person. It's not part of you. You know, a client has given you money to do something. Mm-hmm. So I think that's the hardest part, detaching yourself from the work. Because you spend so much time on it, and it came from your brain in a way, and from the things that you know, the things that you like. So designers get really attached to their work, and I think that's the hardest part, just kind of like letting go. If it's a logo and people think it's bad, 10 years from now, the company will redesign, that logo will go away. So a lot of it is just like looking at it as a piece, as a thing that gets made, not a part of you that goes out into the world.
Is that a point of view that you feel like you've always had, or is that something you've had to learn along the way?
No, I've never understood graphic design as art, or graphic design as this thing that touches people's hearts. I mean, I love Sagmeister, and that's one of his things. And I love when a piece of graphic design communicates something beyond looking good. Mm-hmm. But I've always thought that graphic design is a very rational thing, that is a series of decisions, mm-hmm, more than a series of sentiments and expressions. So I've always had, and part of it is because I never considered myself creative. I consider myself a hard worker. Okay, not that high school proved that, but like the amount of hours I put into Sega Genesis, few people had that patience. Sure. And sure, it's like a stupid thing to spend time on, but I was really one of the best. Of all my friends, I could beat anyone. Mm-hmm. So I worked hard at it. So I think that's what I consider myself, more of someone that can just bang on something until it gets done, mm-hmm, as opposed to someone that just sits down and like, oh, here comes the creativity,
The juices.
Yeah, like, watch out.
Cool. So then on the flip side, what do you think is the best thing about being a designer?
The best thing about when you have clients, which is what most people have, mm-hmm, I love just learning from the clients, what they do, how they do it. It's like you're getting a mini educations on every single subject, with every client.
Whether research phase, where you learn about everything that they do.
Yeah, when they tell you how their company operates, I just really, it's really enjoyable. And when you go on tours of facilities, if you have a FedEx as a client and they take you to a sorting facility, like, oh my God, this is how it happens. Or if you're working for a university and they show you all the ins and outs of how they hire teachers and how it's almost like professional sports where they're poaching teachers from other schools. Mm. So a lot of that stuff is really interesting, and it's probably the best part.
Cool. I guess maybe we've already heard the answer to this. What do you think is, how do you think young designers should go about learning about the business side of design? This seems like something we don't learn about in school very often, if ever. And then a lot of designers come out and struggle with it. And you and Brownie seem to have found a model that works for you. And it sounds like you learned it through practice and through, mm-hmm, mentors that shared a lot.
Yeah. And the problem is that most bosses, most employers want to keep designers out of that whole thing. They just want designers to focus on the work. So they think they're doing them a service by keeping them out of the whole business side of it. Mm-hmm. So the only solution is for designers to ask and to, or I'm not saying that you have to eavesdrop on things, but like pay attention to, if the boss is having a conversation with their accountant or an account manager, like try to listen or ask to sit in so that you can learn about the business side. Because there's really no way to learn it other than doing it on your own. And at the beginning, it's just you take a lot of hard knocks. And that's how most people learn. You draw up your first proposal or your first contract, and then someone finds a way to break it. Not that to break it, but they do something that you're like, oh, shit, I should have put that in the contract, and now we've not been in that situation. Mm-hmm. So then you go back and you amend your contract. Yeah. So a lot of it is just having those experiences. And
practicing and listening.
Yeah, I mean, like, couple of years ago, a client, you know, we delivered a really big set of logo files for them, and they were supposed to pay the remnant of the project, which was $4,000. And, you know, they basically disappeared. So, you know, we have $4,000 that we never got paid for. And now, you know, when our last client, where we had the same thing, we had to deliver the logo files. So like, all right, send me the check, and I'll give you the files.
Yeah.
So you learn, you know, yeah. And the only way to learn is by having those experiences, which sometimes might be unpleasant.
Yeah, but it seems like everybody has that experience or something very similar. Yep. They've all every designer I've ever talked to seems to have learned those things the hard way at some point.
Yeah, and you know, small local AGA chapters. Well, I mean, local AGA chapters, small or big, they do an effort. I think designers have complained so long about not knowing the business side that a lot of AGA chapters do an effort to bring presenters in or do special one-day symposiums about business and how to run things and have designers talk about their business more than their projects.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, a lot of it has to do with going out there and trying to get that information where it's available or demanding that information be presented to you.
Right.
So a lot of it has to do with self-initiative.
Yeah, just going out and looking for it.
Yeah.
So that may be a good piece of advice. But my next question is, what advice do you have to give young designers who are starting out and kind of trying to feel their way through?
I guess not being shy. I mean, I was really, really shy when I first got into when I got that job in, you know, in Atlanta with a large internal consultancy. You know, it was a weird kid from Mexico. I mean, I spoke English and was fine, but you know, I had that. I thought that everything was so out of reach that I couldn't ask questions or I should just do as I was told.
Mm-hmm.
But I kind of like quickly learned that even at that job, like a year in, I was like, you know, I have to, if I want something, I have to take charge. And, you know, it was really hard, but I would go up to my creative director and say like, look, I know you have this new client coming in. I want to be on that project.
Okay.
Or, you know, say, I remember telling my creative director once, like, look, I made this logo out of 20 that you're presenting. So I want to be in that client meeting when you present it. I'll shut up. Like, I won't say anything. You can introduce me as the young designer who's in here. He's not going to say a thing, but I just want to be in there. I want to see how a client reacts to it and how they react to the larger presentation. So a lot of it is just, you know, not being afraid to ask, but knowing your position. Like, just say, like, let me sit in. I'll be quiet. I can be in there. I'll be the official, you know, advancer of the PowerPoint presentation,
yeah.
But I just want to be in there and see how you present, see how clients react, see how you deal with clients.
Did you find that they were open to letting you do that, or did you get told no a lot?
No, I think for the most part, people are like, you know, if he wants to be in and he doesn't screw anything up, why not?
Yeah.
I guess some design firms might be opposed to, you know, having people of certain rank be in meetings. But I think if you work for a decent person, you know, they'll be open to it.
Yeah. Yeah, I could see where there'd be situations where that your time would be better spent elsewhere or
yeah.
something. But yeah, so but generally, it seems like people would be open to doing
yeah.
it. Cool. I think that's a good piece of advice to stop on. So
yep.
Thank you for sitting down and talking to me.
My pleasure.
And that concludes the very first episode of Make Ready. I hope you enjoyed listening as much as I enjoyed recording it. Please join me right here for the next episode coming soon.